Hi, folks. Tom Ivester, an alcoholic.
Hi, Tom.
Member of the Primary Purpose Group in Southern Pines, North Carolina. And my sobriety date is Groundhog Day of 1957. It's not all that bad. You get used to it. I certainly want to thank you folks for the great job you've done on this conference. It's a sea of green out there, and a lot of them don't even have the green on. I really do want to thank you for that. It's been an excellent conference. It's a good bunch of speakers, and I'll fix that in just a minute. But it really has been a good bunch, and the small meetings have been good. And I really like the pace, you know, the pace. There's a lot of fun, a lot of energy, a lot of enthusiasm, and a lot of opportunity to get to know people, which is one of the great values of a conference. And this one probably does it as well as any I know, to let folks get up close and personal and get to know each other. I feel like I know about 3/4 of the folk here, and I'll take that home in my memory bank. And look forward to seeing you the next time. Those of you from Texas, it won't be long, because I'll be down there real quick. That's a warning. And I am delighted to be here. What I want to do tonight is talk all night, but I'm not. That Marty is going to keep me honest. He's going to give me a 5-minute, a 2-minute, a stop, and then a hook. and so I'm going to go by that. And in the interim, what I'd like to do is just share with you as much of my story as I can. Can't share it all, but I would, but I'll share all I can in that time. I guess if I had to I don't put an objective on a talk, but if I have an objective for a talk, most of them, and certainly this one, I'd like, when I get through, I'd like for you to share with me the knowledge that alcoholism is a major league illness, a killer illness, and one that is extremely deadly in nature. I hope you'll share with me a belief that I've developed over the years that 90%+ of the people who have our illness die of it tragically, usually not knowing there's a way out. And I believe those of us who've been fortunate to find this way of life are among the luckiest people on God's green earth. Because if you think of the number of alcoholics in this world, and the relatively small number of us who are in AA, my God, we're barely a blip on the radar screen. And the overwhelming majority go down. And for whatever reason, we've been given a gift beyond estimate. And so I hope you'll sort of join me in that recognition, that awareness, that we're dealing with a tough illness. I'd also like for you to know that what we're sitting in, and you probably already know it, but just to remind ourselves of it, that we're sitting in the middle of a program that works absolutely if we give it all we've got. And it is a powerful program that will work in any circumstance. And so I'd like to be at least one witness to that fact. And I'd also like to communicate as effectively as I can that there's very real hope here. This is the land of beginning again, and hope lives here. And I remember how important that was to me in those days when the future was pretty grim to look at. And so I want you to know there's hope. So that's my task. You know, I'm a regular slice of life. I'm just... I thought I was an extremely different alcoholic when I got here, but I'm not. Might be a little wimpy and, you know, to have to stop so early, but but just a regular garden variety guy. If there's anything different about me, it's the fact that I was an early bloomer and wilted very quickly, too. And I was just one of the early models of the type that we have many of today who are just basket cases from day one. And was fortunate to crash and burn very early. I started my first serious drinking when I was 16 and had what I hope and pray was my last drink 8 years later when I was 24. And in the course of it, completely devastated my life and unfortunately others in the process. So So I'm a fairly typical kind of case. I think I just want to sort of start out right and get cut to the chase and get right to the heart of the thing. And I'd really like to live as much as I can in the land of recovery. But you know, part of the thing of being here as long as I have, the overwhelming majority of my life has been in recovery. One of my ambitions when I first got sober was to be sober as long as I was drunk. Now I've been sober 6 times longer than I drank. And isn't that something? I'm not good at math, but it looks like if I keep staying here, someday I'm going to have been sober forever. It just I certainly won't be here long enough to get to San Antonio when you guys host down there. So I was a guy that, to cut to the chase. Yeah, I was a fellow, when I found myself, and you know what I'm talking about, when I came out of the illusion and delusion of alcoholism and saw myself in clear focus, probably the first time in a number of years, it was not a real good sight that I could see when I started to clear up. When I looked at my history, it was better not to look. Because I'm a 24-year-old guy, and I look back on a history whose legacy is failure. I couldn't think of one single thing that I had accomplished to satisfaction, mine or anybody else's. Anything I could point to with pride and say, well, at least I did that. I mean nothing. I never held a job for as much as a year in my life, except the Army. And I didn't want to hold that one. I kept quitting. But every time I'd quit, they'd come get me and put me in jail. And so I quit quitting, and then they fired me. I got thrown out with an undesirable discharge for alcoholism at the age of 20. And so when I looked at that, that's what I saw. I could not think of any accomplishment, nor could I think of any human. And this is a fact. This is not a soap opera. It's not melodrama. This is a fact. I couldn't think of one human in my connection that wouldn't have literally been better off if they had never seen me. Not one. Not anybody that got close to me lived to regret it. Anybody that got close to me got used, abused, embarrassed, humiliated, terrified, disappointed, just on and on. And that was everybody that I knew. Most people had enough sense to stay away from me, but there were an unfortunate few who made the mistake of getting too close. So that was the legacy. And I could go on with the legacy, but you see what I'm getting at. A guy that was just a basket case and a disaster right from day one. When I looked at the future, there was none. You know, I think one of the reasons I wanted to connect with hope here tonight, when I looked at the future, there was no future. It was like looking into a dark cavern. There was nothing there. No thoughts of a future, no thoughts of any realistic notion that I would have a life. Just a sort of a totally hopeless young fellow, 24 years old. When I looked at my current situation, my present, there was nothing worth looking at there. I was sitting in a maximum custody penitentiary, serving a 15-year maximum sentence for a crime of which I had absolutely no recollection, nor have I ever had any recollection. But I was one of those, like God, most of us in AA can readily identify with the thing, and I hear it all the time, of course, that I was one of those whose bad dreams became an unbearable nightmare. Most of us, particularly those of us who've experienced blackouts, know what the panic and terror is of waking up and not knowing what you've done. Of going out to look to see if you've got a car, if there's blood on it, if it's in one piece. And when there's not, breathe a sigh of relief and go do it over and over again. Did that hundreds of times. Most of us, thank God, stay at the level of bad dreams and don't realize a nightmare. But unfortunately, many do, and I was one of those. What I had done, if I could be nice to myself and say it was an unavoidable accident, but the fact is, I don't know. What I do know, based on what I learned from people who witnessed it, was that I was driving blind, drunk, blacked out down the main street of the city, Flint, Michigan, and ran down and killed two innocent young folks whose only mistake was trying to cross the street that I was driving on. The only thing remarkable was that any time I drove a car on the street, it was like firing a weapon on the street for a guy like me to be driving. And the miracle is that it didn't happen sooner. And so I'm looking at a crime in which two young folks lost their lives, a crime too horrible to punish. I mean, there is no adequate punishment for somebody who takes two lives. How could you balance that? There's no way. And so what I was looking at was not only the mountain of guilt that went with that, but the environment that I was sitting in. You know, I didn't have much feeling left. Yeah, I was a guy that had just absolutely been devastated by that experience, and I had sunk back into isolation like I had never known. And so I wasn't moved with a lot of anxiety or hope. It was just hopelessness. And absolutely felt guilty for every breath that I took. And if you saw that guy, you would not bet much that this fellow's apt to do a turnaround. I didn't believe I would live to complete the sentence in that place. And if events hadn't happened exactly like they did, I seriously doubt that I would have. Because what happened to me, you know, we use a thing called intervention. That the way we know it today had not been invented at that time. But what happened to me, when they put me in a cell, I just sat there. And it was almost like I was comatose. I just sat there and never engaged in any social activity whatsoever, including conversation. I just sat there and did anything I could do to keep from thinking. And some things happened that were to constitute turning points in my life. And I'll assure you, I was looking for none. And I'll tell you this, I obviously can't prove it, but I'm absolutely convinced beyond a shadow of a doubt. If I had had to reach a point where I took initiative to come into Alcoholics Anonymous, I would never have come. And I have not one shred of doubt about that. I was so full of that horrible shame, I couldn't have asked anybody for a glass of water, for God's sakes. Never mind help. There's no way. And I would have sat there till I just cashed it in. But here's what happened. I got a call one day, and some of you that I visited with this weekend, you know that I have a pretty strong kind of commitment, a little mild. I have a pretty strong passion about a cooperation with professional community, which simply means to equip professionals so that they know what to do with drunks they deal with who hit the wall, whatever the wall is. And if they know that, it's because some of us told them about it. And I have the passion about that because that was the axis that started the new kind of a life for me. I got called out for an interview one day by a fellow, social work type of guy, and he gave me something I was very familiar with, just sort of a social history, criminal history, and all that kind of stuff. I'd been through that many, many times. I could fill them out blindfolded, could administer them. They were just repetition. And I'd always had the same diagnosis every time anybody ever examined my life. And it was always something like, geez, you sure drink a lot, or you're an alcoholic, or you're a drunk, or you're a problem drinker. And none of that had any meaning to me whatsoever. I never once accepted that information. I really believed that I was an extremely capable young man if I could just get out of my own way and keep my feet for a little while instead of passing out all the time. I thought I would really do great things in this thing called life. Meantime, I'm incinerating big time. So this guy was no different. He did the same thing, went through his routine, got through, made the same exclamation. He said, "Man, you've had a lot of trouble with booze." And I said, "Yeah, I have." And you know, it was pretty obvious. He said, and most of the time when people would say things like that, they'd say, "Why don't you quit drinking?" Well, I never could think of a good reason to quit drinking. Yeah, it was the only thing I had that I liked and enjoyed and made me feel good. And they're saying, "Why don't you just get rid of that?" You know, Oh my God, that was not very attractive thing. I never had seriously considered that stuff. Now, this preceded the days of a lot of help. You know, there was no such thing as intervention as we know it, and there was no such thing as treatment as we know it. There was no such thing as detox as we know it. We had a very effective detoxes, but they called them jails, and they worked quite well. Blackjacks work very well. If you don't think you get sober, smack a cop. I guarantee you you'll get sober in a heartbeat. But none of that was around. And so what this guy did, he said, you've had a lot of trouble with booze, and I acknowledge it. He said, I think you ought to go to AA. We've got a group here at the institution. I think you ought to go. Now, it wasn't a mandate. It wasn't one of those court order things like we were talking about. This was just an observation from a fellow who was a trained professional, but my God, a wino could have made the same recommendation. Anybody could have diagnosed me. And he said, you ought to go. Didn't say you got to. You'll never get out of here if you don't. It was just a flat objective statement. If you want to eat tonight, go over there. They're cooking over at the building. And I never had heard of AA. I never heard of anybody helping a drunk. That was a totally foreign thing when they threw me out of the military. They told me they'd give me another chance, but I didn't want one. I didn't like it anyway. I thought they were doing me a favor. And so I never had even entertained a notion of help. It was a non-existent kind of quotient. And so the guy got through the conversation, and I left. I don't think he knew much more about AA than I did. What he did what somebody taught him to do. When you see a guy with a file like this, it's all about booze, tell him he ought to go to AA. That's exactly what he did. A few days later, I got a little slip of paper. It wasn't even a letter. It must have been broke. A little small piece of paper said, report, you can go to, didn't say report, said you're cleared to go to your first meeting, Groundhog Day of 57. And I didn't want to go to AA. And I didn't not want to go. I was devoid of feeling. I didn't have any reaction or response to stuff. And you know, the only resistance I had is that I didn't want to mix with people, for God's sake. I'm in total isolation. The last thing I want to do is go and get mixed up with a bunch of people. But I was, thank God, I was so beaten. I was so beaten that I had no fight left. Now, I tell you one thing, bottom and surrender. This gal didn't talk about it last night, but she talks about it as well as anybody I know. Those things are priceless in recovery. And I never would have believed that this series of experiences along here would ever be any kind of a huge turning point or have great value. But what happened in just sort of destroying that defense system I had and reducing me to nothing was a priceless thing. And I didn't know it at the time. You know, there was a guy named Soren Kierkegaard. That's something like that. He lives over in Pueblo, I think. He's an old man. He said something. He said it in fancy language. But it really resonates with what I'm describing. He said, what God would use, he first reduces to nothing. And my God, how fundamentally sound that is. Because that's exactly where I was. I didn't have a busy social calendar. I didn't have any kind of thing. All I had was terminal passivity, and I got up and went, shuffled over like a guy on Thorazine. I was not skipping and jumping to AA or to anything else. I wasn't even skipping and jumping to eat. And so I just sort of shuffled in, no intent of joining. I didn't even know what AA was. It didn't sound nice. You know, God, it looks like we could have found a better name for this thing than Alcoholics Anonymous. Jeez. Secret drunks. Doesn't that just warm your heart? You know, that's what I want to be, an Alcoholic Anonymous. It's not attractive sound. You know, and so I had my own images of what it would be like. I thought there'd be a tent and a few snakes and drums and, you know. I walked in, and I expected no big deal other than just being embarrassed or something. And there was a huge group, darn near as big as this crowd here. You know, not quite, but it We had 300 members in that group. That's why I had to be cleared to go, because I had to have a chair. And so when I walked in, there was one guy spoke to me. They had an officer on the door, not as nice as the greeters. I haven't met a single greeter that wasn't warm and friendly and having fun. Not a one. But that officer wasn't having very good fun that day. He was just standing there. I walked up. He read my name. I was, yes, sir, said, sit down. And I went in and sat down. Had no clue what to expect, and experienced my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't know what you thought about yours, but I'll guarantee you it could not possibly have been any worse than what I thought about mine. We went through what I now know is a fairly familiar routine. We prayed. I knew they were going to do that. The minute they said that prayer, I said, yep, I knew it. I knew it. And then they read that stuff. God, they read everything but the phone book. I didn't know what that stuff was. It sounded like poetry or something. Then they introduced the speaker, and that guy got up, and I've heard drunks tell some wild stories. Some of them true once in a while. I've listened to people in DTs that made more sense than this guy did. And this guy's telling his story and telling stuff I wouldn't have told my best friend, as drunk as I'd ever been. And I thought, why is he doing that? I mean, my God, it looked like exhibitionism or something. And he's up there just undressing his soul in front of 300 hairy-legged convicts. And I thought, my God, what's wrong with him? And he sounded goofy. And the stories he told were bizarre. I mean, they made me sound normal. And so as I sat and listened in fascination, not in identification, in fascination. And when I left there, I didn't identify with one syllable of one word that the man uttered or anybody else. And so I walked out mystified. A week later, I walked back in. Now, nobody sent for me. They wouldn't have come looking for me if I hadn't come back. They wouldn't even known I was gone or cared. But I found myself coming back. And I know without any question, the only thing that brought me back was the attraction of that man and the spirit that imbued his life. That's the only thing that brought me back. You know, we talk about a program of attraction. That's not billboards and commercials. The program of attraction is me and you. We either attract people to this program or we repel them by the way we deal with them. And thank God, I didn't know it at the time, but I connected with the spirit of that man. I think my soul connected with his soul. I didn't identify with anything of the experience, but I found myself sitting back there the next week. Couldn't have told anybody why. Nobody cared why. It was none of anybody's business. But I'm sitting there, and it started what was to be a new life, and I had no clue. The group I went into was called a recovery group. It'll always be my home group. I just don't want to be a regular member. I go back every couple of years to be sure I'm not there. And I was just lost. I mean, I was absolutely lost. Yeah, I'm not exaggerating one ounce. I was one of the most isolated people I have ever met. And for people like me, I'll guarantee you somebody at this conference this weekend has been miserable every day. Now, I don't know who, probably faked it pretty well. But somebody has been miserable. Because people who are severely isolated, you know, warm greetings and hugs and handshakes are not warm and welcoming things. They're frightening things. And they're things that you want to back away from. And so that's the way I was. You know, I didn't feel any sense of community. I didn't feel like, well, I'm home at last. I felt like a guy that was on the wrong planet. And I had no clue that I would ever stay in that. I've never felt more out of place anywhere than I did in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, granted, I was fairly young. By 1957 standards, I was quite young. I was the youngest member in every meeting I attended for several years. When the first guy came in younger than me, I wanted to kiss him. I was so glad. I was so tired of people patting me on the head and telling me how lucky I was to get there so quick. Yeah, I was on a real run of luck, that's for sure. And so, So that was not really an upbeat feeling. It was a kind of a miserable place to be. But yeah, I said this is the land of beginning again. I think one reason that I feel strongly about good, purposeful groups is that that's what I was introduced to. I was introduced to AA in a strong, purposeful group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, it was in a maximum custody penitentiary. Maybe that's why it was a little above average in its strength and integrity, because it needed to be because of the conditions. But I've never been to a better group, and I've been to groups all over this place, and I've never been to a better group. And what I mean by that, it was a group that was clearly purposeful. It understood the fifth tradition and carried it out extremely well. And I am deeply grateful for that. That will always be my home group. And that's where I got introduced. I was introduced by guys, not by rocket scientists or imports from outside. I was introduced to what the vitals of Alcoholics Anonymous are by other guys in the joint. The only difference between me and them was that they had found a program and had found enough to pass on to me. Very grateful for that. Some of the finest meetings I've ever been to in my life. As I was introduced. Now, back then, we didn't do this kind of sort of technological-looking introduction to the steps. Back then, it was a sort of a catch-as-catch-can process. But the guys in the group took a few weeks and took newcomers in the program and introduced them thoroughly to what the program of recovery was, the steps. First place I ever heard the term design for living. That made enormous sense to me. And so I started to get the little crack. Now, it's amazing how minimal the requirements are to get going in Alcoholics Anonymous. What our book says is that all it takes is just a tiny bit of willingness. That's all. No honesty, decency, desire, anything else. Just says, just crack the door. Just enough willingness to crack the door. And so that happened to me in there. And so I got started in a fine group of AA. And became a member. Now, isolated people don't really get garrulous and outgoing right quick. And I learned very early on about the therapy of moving chairs. I'm one of the finest room setter-uppers I've ever seen. I am good at that. Earl Brown and I belong to the same home group, and we set that sucker up. It looks like it's ready for the United Nations. I'm training him, because I'm checking out of here one of these days. And, well, I mean, that was the service, and that was my means of connection, and what a sense of belonging, eh, when you start sharing in the stuff. And so those things started to happen there, and then some things happened. I want to rush up a little bit. I lived in that neighborhood a little longer than I wanted to, but not that neighborhood. Tonight I lived in that neighborhood. I want to move on just a little bit, though, and I don't want to minimize that, because I think a powerful group is an enormously important healing place. Most people don't get into precise working of the steps right off the bat. When I get somebody new in the program, Big Book's not the first thing I hand them. First thing I hand them is a broom or else somebody else's hand, you know, because what I want to do is work on the spirit a little bit and give them a little sense that they're in the right place and that they belong here, that they're not some oddity, nor are they a student. And so what I want to do is introduce them to the chemistry of AA and let them start feeling that spirit. And then we'll get down to business. You know? But that's my bias in that thing. And so back then we did a very, very haphazard way of working steps. Everybody did. We didn't have workshops and seminars and taking people through steps. It didn't exist. And so I started fumbling through the steps. And I'm just going to, y'all mind if I take my beautiful coat off? Thank you. I never thought I'd be in the cold Rocky Mountains complaining about heat. I got my billfold in there. That is dangerous with a lawyer. But I started fumbling through the, and I tell you what, I'm just going to kind of generalize this and get going with it. I want to focus on just one pivotal step in going through this, maybe a couple more. But when I got going through steps, I wasn't sure what I was doing. I fumbled my way through. It was not precise. I did it essentially by myself. And what I found is that the first three steps are essential But they're essentially about two things. One is surrender. It's about accepting defeat. And the other is about finding a power, no matter what it is, that you can hang on to in the hope that you can survive. And those are not really recovery steps in my vernacular. They certainly are the foundation of recovery, but they're not the steps that generate the new life. You know, I know people who have never done any steps who've died sober. I know people who've done the first three and have done very nicely. If all you're interested in is surviving on a day-to-day basis, you can do it quite well. But if you're an aggravated case anywhere even leaning toward the type I am, it will not be a nice place to stay. And so I started fumbling through and got that foundation enough that I had enough nerve to jump into four. Didn't mean to jump into four, but a guy spoke one day, spent the whole meeting on four, got through with it. He demonstrated it. He read it out of the book. I had been thinking about it, and I was really focused on how such a nice guy as me ever got in such a mess. And what I meant to do when I did the fourth step was to explain how such a nice fellow got in such a mess. And so when I sat down on my bunk in the cell after that meeting and started to write, I had a peculiar experience. Some people call it a moment of clarity or whatever you want to call it. I started out to write what I had in mind. I wrote two lines, and then thank God I quit. Now, I didn't quit as a decision. I quit as just a reflex action. I wrote those two lines. I guess I must have seen the charade of my life. But all at once, I stopped abruptly. Nothing dramatic, but in one motion, I stopped what I was writing and opened up and simply started to pour out my heart. That's all. It wasn't any rarefied evaluation columns and all that stuff. What it was a tortured young guy pouring out his life, that's all. But I'll tell you what it was otherwise. That was the first honest look I had ever taken at my life in my entire life. Things came out I'd never even considered. And when I got through with that, I was never to be the same man again. What happened that day was without question the most important day's work I've ever done in my entire life. Bar none. Marriage, college, career, retirement, children. There is nothing more important because everything in my life of value suspends from that experience. So that was a powerful thing. And when I got through, I knew I was an alcoholic without any question whatsoever. That sort of guilt-ridden sense of surrender and bottom that I alluded to a little earlier, that was replaced with a sure conviction and awareness that I'm an alcoholic. I'm a guy who has a terminal, fatal illness whose nature is that if I take one drink of anything with alcohol in it, my chances are slim to none. And I knew that. And I have to tell you this, all these years later, I have never doubted that for one second. Not one second. I've come close to drinking because I understand the visits of obsession. I've only had it a half a dozen times in 48 years, but I've had it. And this program is adequate to deal with it. But what happened that day was fundamentally important, and I have never been the same man. I know who I am. I am anchored sturdily in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm anchored sturdily in understanding my problem. Everything else is symptomatic of that. That's fundamental. That day I became a real member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have never gone to a meeting from that day to this without knowing 100% why I'm there. I'm not here to educate, entertain, stimulate, titillate. Well, forget it. That's not my purpose. My purpose is to share from my heart what my experience is in the hope that it might connect with somebody else and give some hope. It's my job. When I walk in, Debbie used the term about work in the room. I can't remember the last time that I went to a meeting with any thought of what I needed. I mean, it's been so long, it's not even a distant memory. That's not where I go to get my needs met particularly. Not as a direct thing, it's where I go to do my work. Now, I'm active in Alcoholics Anonymous in every element of Alcoholics Anonymous there is. But my most important workplace is my home group. That's where I troll for drunks. That's where I look for folks to come wandering in with their eyes googled. And I know when I see somebody coming there looking like death warmed over, I mean, my heart just warms. I see that. And I, yeah, fresh meat, man. He's mine. And that's what I do. That's where I work, you know. That's where I get my work done. That's where I build a strong place where folks have got a good shot at getting sober and finding a new life. Yeah, that's not a hangout in a coffee clutch and somewhere just shoot the bull. This is a place where alcoholics get well. And so that's my workplace. And so I became a real member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I have never vacillated for one second. So that's why I wanted to focus on that inventory, because that's where it got down to causes and conditions, and some die was set in my life. But when I look at the steps, I'll just kind of glide through this, because Marty's already twitching. when I look at those, forget it, Marty. when I look at the steps, you know, there's a little thing that refers to the steps. It's been quoted here a couple of times in that preface of 12 of 12, and I think it's a very succinct but important statement where it says that our steps are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature. It tells us what the tools are. Which, if practiced as a way of life, not worked or done or seminared or studied or inventoried, doesn't say that. Those are nice activities that lead to an outcome. But that's not what it says. Which, if practiced as a way of life, I don't do the steps. I practice the principles that are in the steps as a way of life. And when I do, life works extremely well. Been a long time since I've focused on me, because the program leads me into being focused on others. So those first three steps, when I look at them, about surrender, that the one I just visited, four and five, are essentially about understanding what I'm talking about when I say I'm an alcoholic. Am I just a guy who drank too much, too long? Is that all I am? Am I just somebody who has problems with alcohol, therefore I'm an alcoholic? No. That inventory taught me that I have an illness fatal in its nature that's permanent. It ain't going nowhere. Got down to cause and condition. It also helped me to start tapping on the door of something called defects of character. That I don't walk funny just because I'm an alcoholic. You know, I don't drive in this peculiar kind of way that I do just because I drank too much and did brain cells. I'm driven by things called defects of character. Now, I'm not going to dwell on that stuff, but all of us, as we start to grow up, go through childhood, grow up, we experience some bangs along the way, some experiences that have impact in our lives. Sometimes we respond to them, shrug them off, and move on. Other times, they create some dents in our life. We call them defects of character. You know, there are things that go inward and hurt. And I'll give you just one quick example. That my father deserted our, well, he didn't desert, he just walked off when I was 4 years old. Sitting in the yard playing, when I saw him walk off, didn't know where he was going, but knew he wasn't coming back. Even as a child, you intuitively know when something bad's happening. And I knew he wasn't coming back. If you had asked me about that any time in my development and just anywhere along the line, I would have looked at you like you did, you know, what are you talking about? You know, I had absolutely no conscious awareness of the damage that was done. But you don't walk out on a four-year-old child without some damage. And so what happened? You know, I tell you, and that's only one of many. And I just visited as long enough to make the point. That what happens, that turns inward. What that produces is a lot of fear, a lot of insecurity, some anger. You know. Now, those weren't articulated. They weren't things that I did, but those are the deep-seated things. And add to that many more. And those are the things that start to produce that compulsive kind of thing that leads to obsessions, because you got to find relief. And booze relieved those things mightily. But you can't stay drunk forever. And so inventory started to take a look at that, is what is it that drives this guy in such a strange way? And then the counterpart of the inventory is the opening up to another human being. And I don't mean to minimize it, but I'll just tell you this. My experience was exactly as it's laid out in the into action in the chapter about the step five. Exactly. I was a man freed. I was a man exhilarated by opening it up to another human. The other thing that happened that was profoundly important to me, it was the first crack in the wall of self-centered isolation that had been my prison forever. And that was the first crack in that wall that was later to become the disappearance of a wall. But it was the beginning. Six and seven were essentially, to me, their decision steps. And I'll visit this just long enough to editorialize just for a moment. They are hugely important, and I think they're really the fulcrum from getting into sort of soul-searching, self-seeking, looking for all of these causation things. And the agenda starts to say with six and seven, okay, you've seen it. You know what the illness is. You know what it's constituted of. At least you've got a glimpse of it. So now, are you ready? Are you completely ready to have God remove all these defects of character? That's not quite as easy a question as it sounds like, is it? Are you willing to change in all of the important areas of your life or not? Are you willing to take a stand or not? Are you willing to say no when yes is so easy? It's a decision point. Do I want to get well, or do I want to just sort of hang on for the ride? And if I can satisfy that, the answer to that question, that I do want to get well, then the rest of the steps are for the getting well process. It's the recovery and restoration process. I just say there two things about that little process that obviously I'm talking about from my own perspective on this thing. Two things that are important about this, that a lot of people that I work with, that I lose, who look like they're doing the steps, tend to get lost at the point I'm at right now. Because they take a look at that and they're just not willing to do it. And there are basically two directions that'll go from there to somebody who stays in AA. One will be to move on into the steps and start doing amends. And start that process that leads to freedom. That's one direction. It's not a very attractive direction if you're looking for an easier, softer way. A lot of people will shift into what I call a pit stop mode of AA, where you see AA is going to meetings to get something, and then if you go to enough of them, you'll be okay. And that's kind of a pit stop type of thing to me. It's not so much a program, it's just sort of a gathering of people who have something in common. They talk. And they'll tend to meet in groups where the only significance to the group is what happens during the meeting. And so it's a direction that's tempting, but it's the other direction where you get into just sort of maintenance, to just surviving. Typically, my experience has been that'll be fairly time limited. Now, some people make it a long time. But on average, it looks to me like folks make it about 7 to 10 years in that. And then obviously, it's going to get old. I mean, God, how many times can you discuss gratitude? You know what I mean. And so it'll start getting old. And the first thing you say, oh my God, Tom, I'm speaking again. Jesus, I was just here 14 years ago or something. Or that same, you know what I'm talking about. It just wears down, and before long it starts to get old, and you start to get missing, and the first thing you know, it's just not worth it. The other one is to go into the thing of recovery and restoration. And it starts with that business of straightening out, not just amending the things to do with the past, but starting to heal those defects of character that drive my life. That's why it's important in the amends process to focus that it's about my side of the street. It's about my actions. It's about correcting my wrong. It's not about getting somebody else to play the game with me. And so it's a very important thing for me to understand that this is my job. It's my responsibility. I don't know what your experience has been, but mine has been that most, not everybody, but most people to whom I've tried to make direct amends and in most cases I've succeeded, I've had to make them listen. Because most of them want to just sort of minimize it and say, oh, you weren't that bad. Or I never have felt bad at you. I have no hard feelings, and just sort of pat you on the back and say, you just keep on doing what you're doing. Well, that means that you know some nice people. But that has nothing to do with amends. That has to do with the behavior of nice people. And what's going on is that I've got to get rid of what eats my lunch. It's what I've done. It's what I've done that makes me feel guilty. It's what I've done that makes it difficult for me to look somebody in the eye. And that's what that amends process is about. And the freedom that it produces. You know, freedom doesn't come from just being dry for X number of years. Freedom comes from the healing on the inside. And that's powerful. I had a great privilege. One of the few advantages I know of being old, I had the advantage of meeting Bill Wilson. And I absolutely treasure that experience. When I listened to him, I never encountered him that he didn't give me words to live by. And I sat in a small meeting with him in Toronto and listened to him describe his vision and to describe about the process that I'm fumbling with right now. And what he talked about, he was talking about tradition, but he got into this and he was talking about, you know, that AA was never intended to be a hiding place for alcoholics. This is not some little glass enclosure that we can get in and be immune from the world. He said, hey, it was never intended to be a hiding place. And he said, what the purpose, the outcome of our program is if I take the action, it will restore me to my rightful place in this world. That meant something to me, really meant something. He said, if you do this, there'll come a day when you'll be able to walk the face of this earth and look any human being you meet in the eye. And I was about up to knees. I heard him. He said, there'll come a day when you'll be able to say to anybody, ask me anything you want to ask me. I've got nothing to hide. That's freedom, folk. That's freedom. Believe me, I know. Because I was a guy who lived in that prison of inability to do that. And so that meant something to me. And that's what this process is about. It's not just about straightening accounts and getting relationships to work. It's about getting my side of the street clean so I'm healthy enough to engage in a relationship. That's what it's about. And so that was powerful for me. And then the last three steps are about, it's about, sometimes we look at them like they're some people call them maintenance steps. I think that's an awfully weak word. I think they're the most powerful action steps in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because their function is to put these principles to work as a way of life. And they do. And my God, and just by doing the daily things we do and putting these principles in, it's amazing what happens in this world. I'd love to talk about it, but I won't take the time to do it. It's just that when I do my daily functions, I live in as nice a world as I could possibly imagine. And it's the same one you live in. If yours isn't a very nice life, you may want to take a look at 10, 11, and 12 because it lays out clear prescription for the actions to take. And so I won't visit any more than that. That set of principles, practices, a way of life, truly are a powerful program. Evidence this. I became a free man, literally, a free man when I was locked up like a wild animal. I'm locked up in a maximum custody penitentiary with nothing that most folks consider important. And I became free. I became a free man. I was physically in a cage, but I was a free man. I experienced the first joy I ever knew in my life, pure, unadulterated joy in that setting. I'm talking powerful program. Talk about self-esteem. That's not some activity we learn. Self-esteem comes from doing worthwhile things. My God, I had 6,000 people locked up with me. Most of them had problems. I had a field day. Man, I'm telling you, when I got into service, there was no limit to work to do. And I had a ball. And I, I, uh, I never did. I hated a place with a purple passion, but I came alive as a human being. Somebody invented television while I was drunk, and and Michigan State University started to pipe the university down, and I enrolled in college, finished 2 years of college. It helped that I was coming off speed, and I was extremely fast in what I was doing. But see what I'm talking about? It's getting restored into things. You know, people say we got potential. That's not a joke. Most alcoholics have a lot of creativity. They got a lot of compulsive drive. Now, not everybody. Man, I know some. It would move well. Anyway. But the majority tend to be pretty anyway. That's what happened. And I think I could probably best describe it, but as I hated the penitentiary as much as any person who's ever been in there, I'll guarantee you that. Every second that I was there. But this program will make you free, and I don't care what the situation is. I was able to live with principle and dignity and honor in that environment. And that's no Tom I skill. That's the power of this set of principles. When it was time, they told me I could leave if I'd go to North Carolina. And I was only there 3.5 years, and they told me that they would turn me loose if I'd agree to go back to the South. And the night I was getting ready to leave, as much as I hated that place, I found myself thinking very privately, geez, I need a couple more days to finish up some stuff I got going in the group. Now, I didn't tell anybody. I wouldn't have stayed 1 second. I believe in rotation, too. So I was ready to go. And when I left, I left with the dreams that any person has. So no matter whether you're coming out of a treatment center or a counseling office or a penitentiary or a hospital, whatever. Yeah, I had the same dream most people have. Mine might have been a little more exaggerated because I'd never really functioned much in the world. I was a loser before I ever got started. And so I just wanted little stuff. I wanted to be physically free. That was important. Yeah, I wondered if I would ever have a friend. Would anybody ever trust me to do anything? Would I be able to get work, and take an honest job and keep it for a change? And, those were just simple little dreams. That I wanted to be a citizen. That sounds like a no-brainer to people who've always been citizens. I had never been a citizen. I'd never paid taxes. I never voted. I mean, I knew people did those things, but not people like me. And so I never did. I ought not say that. They may come get me because I'm sure I owe something. Wouldn't be much, though, if thank you, Earl. But there's little stuff. And I tell you this, dreams come true. And miracles happen. And if I had time, I'd tell you a whole bunch. But I'll just tell you a few just in a rush and hurry. I'm exactly the guy I'm describing to you. I was nobody special. I'm just one other hungry soul looking for a new life. That's all. And my history is exactly what I told you. I had no connections in high places. But stuff started to happen in my life almost at once. We got out. The next week after I was out, the guys took me to the prison. They said, come go. And I said, man, they're not going to let me in. They may not let me out. But it was simpler back then. And so I went. I was back in carrying the message, so to speak. And it's unbelievable. 2 months after I was out, I was named outside sponsor of that prison. Position of honor and trust. I just hit the street. I'm still on parole from a maximum custody penitentiary. And it's about the same time. What I'm describing to you, I characterize as miraculous things. But I have a pretty practical way of defining miracles. I'm a practical fellow. I believe what the book says. It's all right to have your head in the cloud, but you keep those big feet on the ground. And I practice that way. I'm a deeply spiritual man. But I'm not a ritualistic guy. And I have great beliefs in the miraculous power of being in connection with my power. And so miracles happen. I think miracles are what happens when preparation meets opportunity and God does the introduction. It's not some mystical thing. It's a very practical thing. Enough said. And so that 2 months after I was out, about the same time I was named outside sponsor of that prison, pro guy came to me one day, nice man. He said, "Tom, you're real active in his aid." And I thought he was going to ask me to slow down. I knew it wouldn't. And because that was my lifeline. And I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "Wouldn't it help you if you could drive?" Well, for obvious reason, when I left Michigan, they put on my release papers, "This man should never operate a motor vehicle." The letter's that big. And I can read. I knew what that said. And I accepted that as a fact of life. And I told him like he didn't know. And he read the papers. He said, "Let me take a look at it." And he called me a little later and said, "Can you meet me up at the Sears store?" And that happened to be where the license agency was in my town. Now, what I'm telling you is absolutely true. My sister drove me up. Went in, my pro guy back there talking to a fellow, walked up, listened to him talk a little bit. They finally turned around and acknowledged me. And the guy I didn't know, who was the license agent, chatted for just a minute. Nothing about driving, we just chatted. And when he got said enough, I guess, he handed me a driver's license. He didn't even ask me if I could drive. I mean, nothing. No test of any kind, road written, none. Didn't even pay for it. Only cost $4. I'd have had to make an installment plan for that. But you see what I'm talking about, miracles? Yeah, and some people say you must have had good connections with politicians. You bet. Sheriff and I knew each other very, very well. Those are miraculous things. If I'd have been trying to manipulate that into happening, I'd be walking today. When God's got work for us to do, the walls come down. And I don't care what the walls are. Not just my case, but hundreds of cases that we've seen where the impossible happens. So it started to. 5 months after that, I was elected DCM. Now, having gone to Michigan State, I could barely spell it. But I had some vague notion of what it was. Here I have the same guy who wondered if he would ever be trusted by anybody to do anything. I'm asked to be the trusted servant for my fellowship in 15 cities. What a vote of confidence. What a vote of affirmation, really. And, man, things were going great. 2 years after I was out, I was sitting home one day minding my own business, and I got a phone call. There's a fellow in the state capitol who worked with the prison system. And he asked for Mr. Iverson. I got on the phone. I'd met him once. He stopped by the AA meeting that I sponsored and met him and just chatted for 2 or 3 minutes. I had no clue other than that. It was the only contact we ever had. And so he identified himself and he said, "Mr. Iverson, we're expanding the rehabilitation program in our prison system, and we were wondering if you would consider accepting a position." I tell you what is unbelievable about that, but you can believe it. On that day, there had never been an ex-con in history hired into a prison system. And I knew they weren't going to start with this dude. So I said to him, "Do you know who you're talking to?" And he said, "Oh yeah, we've checked you out." And of course they had. And I knew, to him I said, at the intellectual level, I said, "Oh my God, I'd rather do that than anything I could think of. It never crossed my mind. Nor anybody else's, I don't think." And I said, "Of course." And deep down inside I said, "Ain't no way." When God's got work for us to do, the walls come down. Excuse me. And I was employed as a rehabilitation officer, what they call it. They were just starting rehabilitation. It was not an established entity. So I was one of the pioneers of that, and so I went to work, and then I became a professional corrections person. And I mean correctional, a professional too. Yeah, I was not I'm not somebody who markets his wounds or markets his scars. You know, I'm not a professional ex-convict. I took my place in the profession. I established my credentials. I finished my education, and it wasn't because I was so much ambitious. I just wanted to feel legitimately in place for who I was. My career was taking off like a rocket. But I got tired of being the dumbest guy in the room. And so I just finished up my education just so I'd feel appropriate for the experience. But man, it was something else, and it was amazing. I went through a 39-year career and went to the top, the very top of my profession. And never once hear this, never once applied for a job, nor promotion, nor transfer, nor anything. When God's got work for us to do, the walls come down. And what I believe is that when you do good work, God, there's a hunger. Believe me, I've hired hundreds and hundreds of people. When there is a hunger for capable, creative people who will work, a hunger for that. And so, my God, I had more job offers than I knew what to do with, and my career just took off. And one day, the head of our system asked me to come by his office and visit a minute. That's something he wanted me to do. I went in, and he said, "Tom, I'd like for you to take over an institution as warden." Well, I mean, I'm in the system, but that's still shocking language. I mean, he's talking about giving me the Uzi, man. I mean, I said, "God knows, boss, I don't want to be the man. I want to mud wrestle with the guys." And I said, "Tell me what you got in mind." And he wanted me because I'm a limit stretcher. I'm not somebody. If you want somebody to manage something, don't get me, because I'll guarantee you I'll revolutionize it the next day. There ain't no way. I'm not a status quo guy. And he knew that. And so I said, "What do you got in mind?" He told me, and he knew what to say. He said, "There's a kind of facility that I visualize that I'd love to see, and I'd like for you to build it." That's the total of my preparation. Just told me what he said. Here's what they would call it. And here, turning that over to a guy like me, and I mean blank check, go build it. It was the best preparation I've ever had. Because what it did was call on me to bring my creative ability as whatever I had to build it. And I tell you what, we built one of the finest correctional programs you've ever seen there. And he and I both were tickled to death. And that just sort of launched a mold for my career. And I became the guy who started new stuff as I made my career. And that just fits me because I like to just sort of crash walls and do stuff. And had a wonderful career. And I was able to set up a drug alcohol program before I left. I was going to retire, and they asked me to stay and do that. And so we set up an excellent drug alcohol program. And in the last few years of my career, I worked statewide as an administrator and worked with every prison in the system. And just a marvelous career. I wouldn't have traded places with Bill Gates, and I mean that. Would not. Because I was fortunate. And, of course, good fortune depends a lot on my contribution. I mean, it doesn't just not luck. You know, I had a magnificent career with challenge and creative opportunities. And I worked 10 years past retirement and then finally retired. And the day I retired, the guys in AA had already learned. I've been active in AA. I didn't take a sojourn for 39 years. I was active all during that time. And so the guys in AA knew I was going to retire. They had elected me to be the CFC chairman for AA in North Carolina, which meant that I would be the lead man for all of our AA and corrections work in the state in AA. And they came to me with it. And I had some fleeting thoughts, of course, that, gee whiz, man, I've been in a high-pressure career for 39 years. Give me a break. Yeah, I want to go play golf a little bit. I want to go goof off and just stare at my navel or something. And then I thought, a very troubling thought, if there's anybody in this country who understands the dilemma of an alcoholic in prison, it's this cat right here. And if there was anybody in that system in North Carolina who had access to that system, it was me. My God, I had hired half of them. So I had access. And my real belief, it didn't take me long to think it over. Less than a day, probably 30 minutes. Thought it over, and I thought, my God, if I could look at a need like that and at my ability to address it and walk away, I wouldn't recommend me to speak at this conference, nor anywhere else. It wouldn't have been much to me. And so I just took off in it. And my wife says I have the strangest retirement she has ever seen. I've never been busier in my life, nor happier in my life. Yeah, I'm working on my 49th year of sobriety, and I have never been more excited, more creatively stimulated, more active in Alcoholics Anonymous than I am today. I'm a guy who has thoroughly enjoyed. Mine's not a sad story. Mine is a story of coming alive, of vision realized, of a way of life. And I have more fun than anybody has a right to do. I really do. And I wouldn't trade with anybody in the world. I'm a guy that, a very busy guy, and for all of the time I've been in AA, I've been a very busy guy. I'm geared that way. You know, I think our recovery has to match our mode of drinking. I think some of us were talking about that over the week. Our recovery has to match. You know, I was not some sedentary type of drunk who would go sit and sip something all night in one place. I mean, I'm going to start something. I am not going to just sit there and dissipate. So I'm an action guy. And if I tried to recover by getting into some little rote repetition of something, I'd go brain dead in a month. I'm somebody that's got to, I've got to be into stuff and moving stuff and excited about stuff. And so that's what, I'm living proof, unless I'm severely retarded like Jerry, I'm living proof that this thing doesn't get old. I'm living proof that this pink cloud doesn't have to end. You stay on it as long as you do the stuff that puts you there. And so I'm not somebody who sits around yearning for the good old days. My good old days are tomorrow, and they're coming up, and I can't wait. I'm ready to get into those things. The last thing I'll do, and I'll end on this thing before Marty gets to sign out. I've always been in pressure stuff. I'm not somebody who's always had the luxury of time and all this kind of stuff. And a lot of people, I say this because I'm hoping that some of you will respond to this and move more energetically into service. If you're getting lackadaisical in it, that you'll move in. Because there's a huge need for it in our fellowship. Like anybody else, I've had a busy career. I have a family. I have a wife. We celebrated 37 years of continuous marriage last week. And thank you very much. I never thought that would happen. And a couple of kids, you know, they were hellions when they came up, but they both have done well. And my son is a physician. He practices high risk maternal fetal medicine. He couldn't get sued enough with regular OBGYN. and my daughter is a psych major, and she finished up in that. She manages a regional program for development of disabled people. And so I'm proud of my kids. I say that because, you know, because I've had an extraordinarily active life in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I hope you'll hear this and you can go to the bank. There's at least one guy who's experienced this. I don't believe that if I practice these principles in all my affairs, that Alcoholics Anonymous competes with anything in my life. Competes with nothing in my life. If I practice these principles in all of my affairs, I have to practice them in my work, and I practice them in my family. And so I have to figure out how to do a busy schedule effectively. It doesn't compete. It doesn't run in conflict. If what I've done, and I told you the outcome with my kids, now they may go goofy tomorrow, but so far they're doing okay. And my marriage is good. My wife and I have fun. And with this kind of activity, to have those kinds of results, what it says to me is that if I genuinely practice, and I'm not talking about getting off on an ego trip and all this kind of junk, I'm talking about going about it at whatever level of freneticism that you might have, going about that work purposefully and principled, and you will not get hurt. I'll absolutely guarantee you will not get hurt. And so if you have reservations about getting into an active service life, be sure your principles are in place and that you're honest to God practicing the principles that come together. Like in a marriage, there are principles in a marriage. And if if what I do in AA violates the principles of my marriage, then I'm not practicing something. So I'm not talking about just a no-brainer here. It requires some thought, some consideration. But what that produces is, I honestly believe I am the luckiest man on this planet. I truly, I hope you feel that way, but I truly do. When I walked in here, you probably gathered from the case history, I was the most isolated man. I wasn't close to one human. Today, I know a few places, no places in North America, few places in this world that I can go and not have a warm, personal friend who will be delighted to see me, and I'll be delighted to see them. Now, for a guy who lived in total isolation, that's worth the ticket by itself. I know of no human that I can't look confidently in the eye. I know of nobody, just like Bill said, that I couldn't say, and I'd say it to you. If you're curious about anything about me, lay it on me. It's yours. So that, to me, is what this thing does. This is what it does, is gives the hope and a new life. And so I hope very much, if there's anybody here sort of faltering in that thing, invest your life in this thing, and I guarantee you'll never regret it. Okay.